hearing today on the issue of eminent domain. I understand that a newspaper suggested that this was a Vikings stadium hearing, and it's not. So if you're here for that, it's not going to be very interesting to you. So hopefully we can stay out of that topic today and talk specifically about eminent domain. And one of the proposals that's out there, which happens to be my bill, for format purposes, we're not in session, obviously, so we're not going to be voting on the bill or making official amendments to it, but we thought it would be useful, since we're going to have a very short session, hopefully this year, that we start the discussion now, maybe at this time and possibly other hearings once we discuss that. And our format today will be for me to introduce the bill briefly, and then I'm going to ask our committee counsel to actually walk through the bill with the committee and with the audience so that you know what's in the bill. The bill has not been officially introduced yet because we haven't been able to do that in the House yet this year, but it will be shortly. And then we will open it up for 1 hour's worth of testimony from those who are in favor of the bill, or at least in favor of economic development reform of some sort, and then allow an hour for those who are opposed to the bill or concerned about some of the issues raised by the bill. I would like to concentrate today as much as possible on the economic development aspect of eminent domain. We may still get into some of the other issues, such as the attorney's fees or valuation, but if we could concentrate as much as possible on the economic development aspect and kind of what arose from the Supreme Court Keeler decision, I think that would be that would kind of keep us on task, because we do have to be out of here by 5 o'clock at the absolute latest. With that, let me just make a couple of comments about the bill, and then I will turn it over to Ms. Dyson to walk through the bill. This bill, which is available now in a draft form to anyone, really has been a long time in the making. We have been working on it as a group for several months now, but pieces of this, at least, people have been working on it for years, many of them kind of anonymously. And they've had some success on certain pieces of this, and in other areas not much success, and frankly not a lot of attention. And that all changed, as you all know, last June, when the Supreme Court ruled in the Kelo versus City of New London case and essentially affirmed that the eminent domain powers of government entities in the United States are very broad, much, much broader than I think a lot of people in this state and around the country thought that they were. And in essence, what that case said was that a government entity can take someone's property through eminent domain strictly for economic development purposes, as long as they can show that there's some benefit to society, such as greater tax revenue, or maybe even just being able to show that it's part of a plan to beautify the city or make it a better place. To many people in this country, that was a shock, and although it didn't necessarily change law dramatically in Minnesota, because our courts have had a pretty loose standard of eminent domain for a couple of decades now, it got everyone's attention because they were shocked, and I think in a lot of cases people were angry. And because of that, I think we saw formed one of the broadest coalitions politically in the history of this state, and that is the Minnesotans for Eminent Domain Reform, which was the catalyst for this bill that I am introducing in the House and that Senator Tom Bach is introducing in the Senate. And that coalition ranges from traditionally liberal groups to traditionally conservative groups and everything in between. It is a broad range of philosophy, of ideology, of geography, and just about of issue, and just about everything else under the sun. And I'm very proud to be part of that. They all came together because of a principle. And I've heard some folks suggest that, well, this bill is legislation by anecdote. You got a couple of bad stories and you created a bill. This is not legislation by anecdote. This is legislation by principle. And it's a very simple principle that brought all these people together. The principle is this: it should be difficult for government to come in and force someone out of the home that they raised their kids in, or out of the business that they gave their life savings up for, in order to give it or sell it to another private entity who might maybe bring in more tax dollars. That should be difficult. In Minnesota, it's not that difficult right now. and that needs to change. Let me just tell you what I think the three most important pieces of the bill are and then turn it over to Ms. Dyson. Number one, there's an attorney fee provision in the bill. Right now, for a lot of homeowners especially, but also small business owners, I think, to challenge a city government, for example, that is threatening to take a piece of property through eminent domain is very expensive. You sometimes have to spend $10,000, $20,000, although I've heard stories of $80,000 or $100,000 having to be spent. It's not realistic for most people in Minnesota. Wouldn't be realistic for me. And what this bill says is that if a person or an entity, a property owner, challenges a government and wins on an eminent domain issue, they get to recover their own attorney's fees from that government entity. It levels the playing field a little bit. Far from completely, but it levels it a little bit, which is a good thing. There is another important piece of the bill which says that when a government entity is valuing a property for an eminent domain taking purpose, they have to consider, for a business, for example, the going concern value. It's not always just the value of the building and the piece of land, but you have to look at whether maybe that particular location is of unique value to that particular company. So that's another very important piece of the bill. And then the third piece of the bill, which is kind of the heart of the bill, is what arose out of the Kelo decision. And that essentially, in a nutshell, says that government cannot take from private entity A and give or sell or otherwise transfer to private entity B for economic development purposes unless the government can show that there is something significantly wrong with that piece of property. But if nothing is wrong with the property, it will not be allowed any longer. What can they show is wrong with the property? They can show that it is a public nuisance under the law. They can show that it's environmentally contaminated under the law, that it's abandoned under the law, or that it is blighted under the law. And my guess is we'll be talking a lot today about the definition of blight, because this bill contains a new and strict definition of blight, but it's a reasonable definition. That's another very important change to the bill. These are all significant changes. I won't kid you and suggest that we're just tweaking the law a little bit. The law doesn't need to be tweaked. It needs to be changed significantly. So that's what we're doing. Having said that, while it's significant, this is also very reasonable. We will have a lot of members of the legislature suggesting that this bill needs to go further. I guarantee you that. I even feel that maybe pieces of this need to go a little further. But what we've come up with, I think, is a very reasonable proposal that makes some necessary changes to protect property owners in the state of Minnesota. With that, I would like, where did, right there. I would like to turn it over to Ms. Dyson, who maybe can walk through the bill for all of us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Deb Dyson from House Research, and I'm going to fairly quickly walk through what the bill covers after the chair has given you an overview of the major points that he's working on with the bill. Looking at first at Section 1, this is amending the section of Chapter 117 of Minnesota statutes that provides the procedures for eminent domain, and the section that contains definitions. It in the first part, it makes it clear that these definitions apply to general and special law of anyone exercising the power of eminent domain. The next change in Subdivision 3 on the definition of owner is a technical clarification. Subdivision 4, the condemning authorities, just anybody who's exercising the power of eminent domain. In Subdivision 5, this is where there's a definition of what does it mean when a property is abandoned, and it's focusing on that it's not legally occupied and it's for which the condemning authority cannot locate the owner. But it also has to show that there's physical evidence of abandonment, boarded up windows or doors, broken windows or doors, trash and debris accumulating, terminated utilities. As the chair said, the next subdivision that defines blighted area, and in the bill it's on page 2 of the bill draft in front of you, which is the definition of blighted area, and it's it's defined as an area that in its present use and condition meets the conditions listed, and it reiterates a burden of proof, an increased burden of proof that's also elsewhere in the bill, that it has to be established by clear and convincing evidence. The definition includes criteria that 70% of the area is occupied by buildings, streets, utilities, paved or gravel parking lots and other similar structures, and that more than 50% of the buildings in the area are dilapidated. The definition goes on to state when a building would be considered dilapidated, and that's the building's been cited for enforceable structural building code violations within 3 years immediately before the condemnation, the building has not, there hasn't been a remedy of those violations within a reasonable time period, but not to exceed 1 year after the citation, and that the cost of the repairs to make it fit for human use exceeds 75% of the assessed value for property taxes payable in the year in which the condemnation was commenced. And then it goes on to list what are the elements are of an enforceable structural building code violation. The next definition for environmentally contaminated area is an area that is contaminated over more than 50% of the surface area and for which investigation, monitoring, testing, and cleanup costs are more than the assessed value of the property. The list of hazardous or contaminated substances is a very broad list, if anything that's listed anywhere in state or federal law or rule. Both the definition of blight and environmentally contaminated area are defined because they are part of the definition of public use, which is the requirement for a taking. In Subdivision 8, the definition of public nuisance that you see in the bill is by cross-reference to the criminal statutes. In the bill summary, it quotes what the statute states for what is a public nuisance. It's a failure, it's by an action or a failure to perform a legal duty intentionally, and it maintains or permits a condition which unreasonably annoys, injures, or endangers the safety, health, morals, comfort, or repose of any considerable number of members of the public, or interferes with, obstructs, or renders dangerous for passage any public highway or right-of-way or waters of the, used by the public, or is guilty of any other act or omission declared by law to be a public nuisance and for which there is no sentence specifically provided. Subdivision 9 is the last of the new definitions added to the statute, and that's the definition of public use or public purpose. And the three elements there are the possession, occupation, and enjoyment of the land by the general public or by public agencies. If creating or functioning that something that is for the creation or functioning of a utility or other public service corporation, or that mitigates blight, remediates environmentally contaminated areas, reduces abandoned property, or removes a public nuisance. The definition specifically provides that public benefits of economic development, including increase in tax base, revenues, employment, general economic health, do not by themselves constitute a public use. Section 2 of the bill, titled Condemnation for Blight, Contamination, Remediation. In this section, the subdivisions are stating that it's when you have non-dilapidated buildings in an area that is proposed for blight mitigation, you need absolute necessity to take those non-dilapidated buildings before in order to complete the removal of dilapidated buildings before you can take the non-dilapidated. Similarly, for uncontaminated property, it would prohibit a condemning authority from taking uncontaminated property unless it's absolutely necessary in order to complete remediation of contaminated property. And then the third provision in this section prohibits considering blight caused by a developer involved in the redevelopment of the area in determining whether the area is blighted. Section 3 is the attorney's fees provision that Chair Johnson discussed in his introduction. Section 4 is a continuation of the attorney's fees issue, but prohibits awarding attorney's fees and costs to condemning authorities in condemnation actions. It also prohibits awarding a local government attorney's fees in an action brought under the TIF law, tax increment financing law, if the TIF district includes property taken by the local government by eminent domain. Section 5 of the bill is in the section of the eminent domain statute relating to the petition and the hearing on the petition in the district court. And it requires a condemning authority at the hearing in district court on the petition for condemnation to show by clear and convincing evidence that the taking is necessary for public use and that just compensation is paid or secured. Under current law, the courts describe the burden of proof or the standard of proof that the public, that the courts would not overrule a public use determination by a legislative body unless it is manifestly arbitrary and unreasonable. That's the way the courts currently look at it. In Section 6, there's a new provision that in the procedures that says that if there's an appeal of the district court's determination of whether a taking is necessary and for public use, the Court of Appeals reviews this de novo. They look again at the from the beginning at the facts and the issues. Section 7 is compensation for loss of a going concern, which Chairman Johnson discussed in his introduction. This provides the owner of a business or trade compensation for loss of a going concern related to the taking of real property. It specifies that the claim can be avoided by the condemning authority upon a showing by clear and convincing evidence that the loss is not due to the taking, it could have been avoided with reasonable measures, or that it duplicates compensation otherwise being awarded. It requires the property owner to give the condemning authority at least 30 days notice before the commissioner's hearing if the owner is going to ask for compensation for loss of the going concern. Section 8 of the bill adds a section, it's called minimum compensation, and it's requiring compensation to allow the owner to purchase a similar house or building in a community, and it provides that the compensation cannot be less than the quick take payment or deposit. It's sort of a replacement value type of compensation. Section 9 of the bill, titled Limitations, this section prohibits a condemning authority from requiring an owner to accept as compensation a substitute property or return of property taken. Section 10 adds a section to the condemnation process that applies to cities and counties and towns specifically. And it requires the governing body of the city, county, or town to hold a public hearing on a proposed taking by a local government or an agency of the local government, the HRA, the EDA, Port Authority, whatever. The hearing would, there has to be public notice published in the paper or on the web and also specifically provided to the property owners before the hearing. And then it provides for public testimony and then requires the city council, county board, or board of the township supervisors to vote on the proposed taking at a regularly scheduled meeting a certain number of days after the conclusion of the public hearing. Section 11, the sections 1 through 10 are making changes in the Chapter 117 of the statutes, which are the eminent domain procedures statute. Section 11 begins some changes that are in the section of law that specifically deal with economic development activities that are authorized by statute, such as by HRAs and EDAs and those others. The first one in Section 11 is amending a definition of blight in the sections dealing with HRAs and just says that if for the purposes of acquisition by eminent domain, blight or blighted areas that's used in those laws has to meet the same standard as in the eminent domain statute, so it provides a cross-reference. The same thing for in Section 12 for public use or public purpose. It's providing a cross-reference and saying, however else public use is defined in this statute, when you're talking eminent domain, you have to meet the eminent domain standard for public use. Section 13, it's a similar cross-reference for the definition of marginal property. This is in the sections of law relating to port authorities. And then Section 14 is actually amending a special law that is codified in statute for the Winona Port Authority, but does this make the same cross-reference change. Section 16 is striking the authority to use eminent domain by municipal redevelopment agencies. And then Section 17, the same thing in city development districts. Section 18 is a conforming change related to the city development districts. 19 is a reviser instruction for terminology throughout use throughout the statutes that would change right of eminent domain to power of eminent domain. The repealer in Section 20 is repealing the authority of an area redevelopment agency to use eminent domain, and then the effective date is day after enactment, but applying to eminent domain proceedings that are commenced on or after March 1st of 2006, which is the scheduled first day of the next session.
Good job, Ms. Dyson. Thank you. Welcome, everyone. Just a couple public service announcements. First of all, colleagues and anybody who's going to testify today, if you'd ensure that you speak clearly into the microphone. Apparently, folks in the back and out in the common areas are having difficulty hearing the testimony. So if you would be mindful of that when you speak, that would be great. Also, I want to recognize this afternoon we do have some of our colleagues here with us who are not a member of the Civil Law and Elections Committee. I see Representative Andy Westerberg from the Blaine area is here, his hometown. I know that Representative Connie Bernardi from the Fridley area is here as well. I don't see her, but I know she's around. And I think I see Representative Phil Krinke as well from Lionel Lake. So we send a welcome to our colleagues for this hearing here this afternoon. Next, what we're going to do is in about the next 10 minutes or so, we have allocated for committee discussion and dialogue with respect to the text of the bill. What we will then do is move into 60 minutes of testimony for the proponents, if you will. And I note that that is a block of time, proponents, so you amongst yourselves must allocate that. So if you're the first speaker and you speak for 55 minutes, you're leaving 5 minutes for your peers behind you. With any remaining time after the proponents speak within the 60-minute block, we will have committee discussions or questions if need be. Therefore, witnesses, if you'd stick around as well, committee members may have a question for you, so we would appreciate that. As I mentioned, after that 60-minute block, we will move into an identical block for opponents. After that, we do have approximately 8 people who called Mr. Verdon previously and asked to address the committee, and in the remaining time, we will try to accommodate them. Finally, I would note that in between the two 60-minute blocks for proponents and opponents, all those who are caffeine and tobacco dependent, we will take a break so you can get plussed up there before we come back. Having said that, now we'll entertain any questions or dialogue regarding the text of the bill. Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the author. Representative Johnson, used to calling you Mr. Chair. I had a question for you about, you said today that we're not going to legislate by anecdote, but we're going to legislate by principle. And my question has more about legislating by precedent. I was wondering, just to get some background on this, how often is eminent domain used in Minnesota? It seemed that the Kelo versus New London case really didn't expand eminent domain powers. It really just reaffirmed the authority of governments to acquire property for economic development and redevelopment purposes. So do you have any statistics on how often this is used, how often Sure. it's been used to remediate contamination or clear title for affordable housing or for access to health care?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Slawick. I will answer questions as best I can, but there are a couple people here who might be better at answering some of the numbers questions, such as Lee McGrath or Alyssa Shalander, and I don't know if either one of them is available. You might be able to give some more accurate numbers than I am able to.
Okay. Good afternoon, Ms. Schlander. We'll recognize you to answer the question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Kowalik, I'm sorry that I don't really have an answer to your question.
Ms. Schlander, if I could interrupt for a minute, too, please. Always remember to identify yourself for the tape. We're taping the proceedings so people who listen later will be able to remember who said what. Thank you.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I'm a little out of practice. Alyssa Schlander, I'm the lobbyist for the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. In short, no, I don't have an answer to your question about numbers because it's pretty hard to document how often eminent domain is used because it is so often threatened and not the procedure of eminent domain condemnation is not always followed through to the end, but the issue of how often local governments or government entities threaten to use eminent domain to get people to voluntarily sell their property for a public project is very difficult to document.
Representative Slawick.
Mr. Chair, so you have no idea how often, or the precedent on how often this is used in Minnesota, or I guess what I would request is if we could get that information at this point, it'd be after the hearing.
My colleague, Lee McGrath, you may have a better answer that satisfies your question.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. McGrath.
Thank you so much, Chairman De La Forest. Good afternoon, I'm Lee McGrath. I'm an attorney with the Institute for Justice. We're a not-for-profit public interest litigation firm. My colleagues in Washington, D.C. represented Suzette Kilo and the other property owners in Washington, D.C. and New London, Connecticut before the United States Supreme Court. Mr. Chairman, Representative Slavik, my colleague Dana Berliner has put together a report between 1998 and 2002. In that, it showed that nationwide over 10,000 times municipalities have threatened to use eminent domain used eminent domain for private economic development. In that part of that report is a report on Minnesota. It's very difficult to get comprehensive numbers in Minnesota, but Dana Berliner did identify that there were approximately over those 5-year periods there were 2,000 condemnations. Of those, looking at newspaper reports, she was able to identify approximately 92 were private-to-private transfers, roughly 5%. Representative Slavik, if 5% of newspapers were shut down, you would be upset and it would be considered a violation of the First Amendment. If 5% of criminals did not receive a jury trial, or were not, or the prosecutor did not have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they were guilty. So 5%, although it may seem small in number, is a significant number when one considers that the Constitution protects individuals, and every misuse of eminent domain is a constitutional violation.
And Representative Slawick, we'll go to you, and also noting I have Representatives Lesh and Simon as well who wish to ask questions during this phase. Representative Slawick.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, so that was 92 or of 2,000 cases or 5% over what time period?
Between
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slawick, that was between 1998 and 2002.
Thank you.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a few questions for the author also. I didn't get a chance to read the language of the bill until this week, and I saw a few things, and I think the language is very similar to what we have here in front of us now, the language that I read. But first question would be, in Section 2, the first part, line 3.20 on page 3, states that in order to, in taking a property to mitigate blight, a condemning authority must not take non-dilapidated buildings in the area unless it is absolutely necessary in order to remove them. I don't really know what that means. What does absolutely necessary mean?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to turn over to Mr. McGrath as well, since he seems to have a good answer.
Okay. Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, absolutely necessary is a legal term here in Minnesota. It means that there are no other alternatives but to take the property. What this provision does, it addresses the so-called holdout problem. Imagine, if you would, that there are 10 properties. 9 of them are blighted, but right in the middle of them is a non-blighted property. It would be very difficult. In fact, it would be absolutely necessary for any sort of economic blight mitigation to occur, that the municipality take the non-blighted, non-dilapidated building that is right in the middle. And so what this provision does is that it allows and empowers municipalities to take non-blighted property. It empowers them to take the so-called holdout property with only the requirement that they show that the reduction of blight or the reduction of contamination could not occur without the taking of that non-blighted, non-blighted, non-contaminated property.
Okay. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure if I'm going to be asking all these questions of Mr. McGrath or not, but if I am, I'm not familiar with the Institute for Justice. Mr. McGrath, can you tell me who you told us a little bit about you, but who funds you and who are your supporters?
Mr. McGrath, before you ask, is that something you might cover in the proponents portion of testimony?
The proponents who are going to speak, Mr. Chairman, are going to be just property owners. I did not anticipate speaking at that time period.
Okay, fine. Then if you'd answer the representative's question, that would be great.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, the Institute for Justice was formed in 1991. It is a not-for-profit public interest litigation firm. We do not charge our clients any money to represent them. We have represented property owners today we argued in front of the Ohio Supreme Court, but we also argued in front of the United States Supreme Court in the case of Kelo. We have 4,000 donors around the country, and they give us approximately $6 million, from which we employ about 45 people in Washington, Phoenix, Seattle, and 2 people in Minneapolis, half of whom are lawyers.
Okay.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. McGrath. I guess what I'd like, if possible, and we don't need to do this on the record, but if I could get some kind of list of supporters, and if you have funders, it's just worthwhile for me to know when we're talking about this. The other question I have, and I'd ask this of the Chair, but absolutely, Mr. McGrath, if you choose to answer it as well, that's fine. One of the things I saw in the general prohibition, I guess that's on page 4, was, and this was discussed obviously by the author in his introduction to the bill as well, was you didn't just change the burden of proof to the condemning authority, but you changed the standard of proof too, and substantially upped it to clear and convincing. Why was it that both of those were necessary, not just changing the burden, but changing the standard?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Lesh, and I will let Mr. McGrath follow up on this as well. And just as a little further background, I think that Mr. McGrath's organization probably is recognized as one of the preeminent organizations when it comes to eminent domain reform issues around the country. So he's a very good spokesman for the coalition that Senator Bach and I are part of. And he played a significant role in drafting this bill, which is one of the reasons that I welcome him to give his input on it. But we're talking, and sometimes I think people forget this. I sometimes hear folks say, well, you know, we're talking about the public good here, and where would Richfield be without Best Buy, et cetera. I think those are valid arguments. But sometimes you have to separate that from the fact that we are talking about a constitutional right here. We're talking about one of the most fundamental rights of any individual in this country, and that is the right to own a home or own a piece of land or own a business or a farm or whatever. And I think increasing both burdens is an important move because, to me, if you're going to do that balancing act of
public good versus constitutional right to own a piece of land, I am almost always going to lean in favor of the individual right there as opposed to the public good. Unless, of course, you're able to show that the owner of the property isn't taking care of the property or is misusing the property in an illegal way, or you can show that you're going to build a school or a road or a government building on it as opposed to just transfer it to another individual. And I would invite Mr. McGrath to add to that.
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, thank you. Representative Lesch, for government entities like MnDOT, it will be relatively easy to meet the burden of showing a road, or for a school district to showing that they're building a school, or for the post office to show that it is building a post office. These are not significant legal hurdles for such government agencies. Where we come down to the great question is on the issue of blight. And it should be difficult there should be checks and balances. We shouldn't empower municipalities to act autonomously as they currently do today because of the great deference that is in the court. So as Representative Johnson said, this bill does make it more difficult, intentionally makes it more difficult, but it is not the level of criminal. It is midway between what you see in civil cases and what you see in criminal cases. It is the level of clear and convincing evidence.
Representative Lesch, last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last question I have is for the author as well, and I say this as a lawyer, and also I've heard a lot from some constituents, some community development corporation folks in my district and things who are very concerned about this bill. That said, I'd preface my question that I have some sympathy for the bill, and I think I understand the direction you're going, Representative Johnson. But I'd say I recall, I don't know when it was, when you announced your race a couple months ago, that one of your concerns for the public good was the state should not sue first and ask questions later. And as I read through this bill, I see a lot of new causes of actions for attorneys. And I'm an attorney. I should love that. More work for me. That's great. But I wonder how much does that concern you that you're opening up a lot of new causes of actions for lawyers. And how is that going to impact taxpayers if there really is a need and demand for a certain direction to be taken with respect to city planning?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lesch, I don't see any new causes of actions for attorneys here. I do see causes of action for homeowners, especially those that maybe can't afford to otherwise fight City Hall. And I think that I have never been, you may note, a big fan of attorney fee provisions, especially one-way attorney fee provisions when they've come before the committee, because I think there's plenty of litigation out there right now. This is very different, though. We are talking about the government coming in and forcing someone out of their home. And if I can make that harder and give individuals more rights to fight back, I don't see, there's no downside to that, in my opinion. And if it does end up costing a little more, or even a lot more. That's not an ideal outcome, but I'm willing to make that sacrifice in order to protect people's rights to their homes and property.
Thank you. Representative Simon, we'll try and squeeze you in on the backside here unless you have a very brief question. I'll wait. Okay. We'll get you in there. Introduce the proponents of the bill, call on Ms. Schlander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. As I've already introduced myself, I'm Lisa Schlander with the Auto Dealers Association. I'll just start by saying thank you for taking the time today to hear about this important issue. Ever since the city of Richfield forced out three of our auto dealerships out of the city in 2001 so that the Best Buy Corporation could occupy that space at 494 and Penn Avenue, the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association has been working with the legislature to reform Minnesota's eminent domain laws, and frankly been pretty much alone in this fight until this past summer when the U.S. Supreme Court handed down its decision in Kelo. And as you know, what the Supreme Court did in June really sparked some outrage. I think a lot of people really didn't realize that that is what could happen to their property, and for the reason of purely economic development, of really just plain increasing the tax base. But with that said, I need to reiterate what Representative Johnson had said in his opening remarks, that we are not knee-jerk reactionists to Kelo. We've been at this for the past 3 or 4 years, and we've been developing legislation long before Kelo made the headlines. We're interested in passing good law and law that works in Minnesota. We're working with this coalition called the Minnesotans for Eminent Domain Reform, and as Representative Johnson said, it is a really diverse coalition in all senses of the word. That we really feel like this is not a partisan issue. This is just an important issue that citizens care about from all sectors. And it's a diverse coalition of people that just think that the current state of the law is unacceptable. We've already been through several versions of this bill, working with Representative Johnson, Senator Bach, members of the Independence Party, formerly, and we've already really incorporated some valid concerns that were brought to us by the League of Minnesota Cities and others. And so we are listening, and we are working, and we're trying to pass good workable law. We think Representative Johnson's bill is good and it's reasonable. And I'll just to reiterate, the bill still allows eminent domain to be used. We are not trying to end all eminent domain use. We're not trying to end economic development. The bill still allows eminent domain to be used for traditional government purposes of roads and schools and bridges, of utilities. It still allows cleanup of environmentally contaminated areas, to clean up nuisance properties, and to mitigate blight. Representative Johnson in his legislation has recognized the need of local government to use this tool. But our view is that this is just an attempt at simple fairness, to put some fairness back in the process for property owners who are really treated unfairly and are really not protected by the current state of the law. So really what we're saying is that it's unfair that government gets to act as a real estate broker to take property away from some people so that other people can profit from it. And I think it's not a stretch to say that most people would agree it's time that the legislature did something about that. We've got several people here today, just real property owners, homeowners, business owners who have been affected in some way by the current state of Minnesota's eminent domain laws, and I'll turn it over to them now. Jim and Beverly Mead are homeowners from Champlin. Dan Vang, whose family owns a grocery store in Brooklyn Center, and Mark Foreman, who owns a business in Bloomington. So I'll turn it over to Jim Mead now, and I thank you again for your willingness to take the time today to discuss eminent domain.
Thank you, Ms. Schlander. Mr. Mead, good afternoon. Welcome to our committee. If you would kindly identify yourself for the tape, please, and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Jim Mead. I live in Champlin, Minnesota. I live on the river at 27 East River Parkway. And you'll have to cut me a little slack because I'm not familiar with any of the jargon that goes on around here. I'm just a hard-working slob who bought a property on the river over there 30 years ago. My wife, Beverly, and I bought this house, and it was a house that we went and seen with the real estate guy, and when we told him we'd take the house, he was just amazed. He says, why is that? He says, we've been trying to sell this house for over a year, and every client that I ever take here, they look at the house, and they look at the apartments on each side and across the road, and they say, hey, get out of here. We don't want to live here. And they were amazed that we wanted to take that house. But we seen the vision of where we wanted to live and retire on the river. I'm a fisherman. We do boating. My kids are all into it, and we just have one heck of a good time there. We raised our children there, and the bottom line is, I'm not moving. It's not for sale. I want to die in that house. I'm 77 years old. How many more years can I have to enjoy my retirement? Now they want to take it away from me. And I just don't know what I can do. I don't have money to fight the thing with attorneys and such. And the city of Champlin is unbelievable how unfair and how threatening they are. And they stood up at the council meeting last Monday, and I have a tape of the whole thing that they get over there, and it's unbelievable. Mayor Boynton started right out, well, we're not going to use eminent domain. Then they proceeded to tell us that the EDA, which is some kind of a development authority that they have, and they have the ability to take our tax money or parts of it and buy properties over in Champlin for redevelopment. And then it came out that they have 40% of the land that they want, that's including my house. They don't have my house, but they've got some of the others, and they aren't telling us who has sold to them, but they are all willing sellers. They also identified myself and Dan Fryer, who owns an apartment building over there. We are unwilling sellers. Now, the head of the EDA some time ago told me one time when we were talking, he says, why don't you just take our offer? He says, we're going to get your house one way or another. And I'm not sure just what he meant, but I'm looking at the situation now. They tell us they don't have a plan. They don't have a developer. They've had a developer, and the developer fell on his butt because he didn't have any money. So it all fell apart at that point. But we're still under that same threat. They're going to take this area, and they have marked off 270 acres, and they've divided it up into five areas. I'm in area number one, commonly referred to as the Gateway. And it's a beautiful piece of property. Even Tom Hauser, who came out there with Channel 5 and videotaped our land and our house and our activities there, says, I can see why the city would want this. Says, this is a fantastic place. You can build that restaurant over there, and you can have a marina, and you can have a hotel, and they're talking 330 condos there. They're going to make a lot of money someplace down the line. Somebody is, because that's what it's all about, I guess. But the whole thing is such an unfair thing, and you can't imagine the frustration and the depression that can be caused by having this threat of, we're going to throw you out of your house. We're going to take it all away from you. We worked hard for that house. We spent 30 years working, buying, paying, whatever, taxes, mortgage, all of that stuff, and we built that house up to where we wanted it so that we could sit there and have a retirement property. And now they want to take it away from us. I have no idea where I'd go if they threw me out. Maybe I'll put a tent out down by the waterfront, live there. I'm not selling. There is no amount of money that they could come up with. And I've told the mayor that we're unwilling sellers, and he has qualified us as unwilling sellers. Well, what are they going to do if they do this big project that they're talking about, and this is just the phase one, and they're going to take 7 apartment buildings in my house in that area. They already own 40% of it, according to what they said at the meeting. And if the builders come in there and they build a plan, are they going to build around Dan Fryer's apartment and my house? I hardly think so. All of the plans we've ever seen from the previous developer, who never made it, shows nice straight lines. Everything is all just a beautiful development in that fashion. And there's no way that our house and his apartment would ever fit into the aesthetical looks of what that's going to look like when they redevelop it. So I'm hoping that the Minnesota law people will do something to protect people who have property. We need our rights protected. And I'm hopeful that this Reform Act that's being offered by Representative Jeff Johnson will change the eminent domain law and will close the loopholes that permit the taking of properties. Now, my property is going to be inspected Friday. A company called LHB has the monopoly in Minnesota to go in and inspect houses. And the mayor says, yeah, but we aren't going to condemn your house. Why are you inspecting it? We have to inspect it so that we can identify the length of the tax increment finance bond that we can go for. Well, when you get all that money, what are you going to do with it? Well, we'll use that money to build the apartments and everything, so you can use that money. That's something else. I don't understand all of these legalities of how people can take your tax money and go off and beat you over the head with your own stick. And I told the mayor that, and he said, I don't understand that. He says, we're not beating you over the head with your own stick. What do you call it when you take my tax money and go out and buy property and then tell me, get the hell out, we're going to take over your property? It's disgusting. It just scares hell out of us. And we want to live there. We retired. We expected to live our lives out there. I'd like to get another 10 years of fishing on the Minnesota, on the Mississippi River there, and enjoying the backyard. The tenants that are in the buildings over there, a lot of them are long-term people. Some of them people have been there as long as 15 and 20 years that they've rented there. And they're upset. Where are they going to go? They're concerned as well. And there is no purpose for them. They're just going to throw them out and tell them, well, go find a place, someplace else to hang your hat, because we're going to tear it all down. And I just don't know what else to say. It just gets me so frustrated. Excuse me. But we want to live there. We want to live our retirement out. And I don't know what I got to do to fight this thing to stay there. But the whole intent was 30 years ago when we bought that property and envisioned what we were going to do with it, how we were going to make improvements, and how we were going to have our retirement home. I never dreamed that the government would come along and take my home away from me. Just can't believe this is happening sometimes. It's scary. I heard from a gal down in Chaska. She called me. And she said, I see all your activities going up there, and I want to tell you about what happened to me. And this is a few years back. She and her husband had rental properties down in Chaska. That was their 401k retirement plan. The city of Chaska came over and gave her a check and told her, 60 days, you're out of here. Then they proceeded to tear the buildings down. In the meantime, her husband died. She's still living in another residence which they own, and she's getting along, but I don't know what she's doing financially, because I never did find out how much money they paid her. But all of the things that people tell me, you never get paid what you really should be paid for. And people are always telling me they're always undercut on the payment. They were never given the just payment for their properties. Well, then I asked her, well, what did the city do? Did they build a big apartment down there? She says, no, that's 4 years ago. They raised it all down. It was nothing but dirt. And today it's nothing but a grass field. Now, I don't know what Chaska is going to do with it, but that's an example of some of the things that can happen to the poor slobs like me who are out there trying to live through the American dream, and all we get beat over the head by the government. I don't understand this government at all anymore. I look at the Constitution, and I always thought that the Constitution was going to provide us with freedom and the ability to do things, to own property, to have free speech and all of those good things. And every time I turn around, somebody is whittling away at it. They passed this Feingold-McCain finance bill, and I see in the NRA magazine, another big scam to take your freedom away. Thank you much.
Mr. Mead, thank you. Folks, please, let's maintain some decorum. I see that Beverly Mead is also on the list. Mr. Mead, I assume that's your spouse. Is she interested in making some remarks today?
That's correct. She isn't here today because she's down with a cold and the flu.
Okay. We'll note that. Thank you, Mr. Mead. Next on my agenda list is Mr. Mark Foreman. Mr. Foreman, are you here today? Good afternoon, Mr. Foreman. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the tape, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mark Foreman. My wife and I, along with our three children, live in Bloomington, Minnesota. Have for the last 17 years. We've owned a commercial building at the corner of France and Old Shakopee Road for the last 13 years. We acquired that building for a number of reasons, but I think one of the main reasons was because it was close to our house. We were able to walk to work, and Gail and I always ran the accounting firm together, and it enabled us to kind of do both, you know, run the household and work at the same time because of the proximity, you know, just being a few minutes away. And we also have one of our children is has special needs, has autism, and so we homeschool him. So able to, you know, whenever she's at the office, I can go home and vice versa, and so that is one of the reasons. So we bought that building about 12 years ago. It had sat empty for about 3 or 4 years, and we basically rehabilitated it. You know, paint and carpet, and changed a few walls here and there to make it more conducive for offices. We moved our accounting firm in there and rented out some of the other offices to other tenants like lawyers and architects and people like that who also lived close by. And for 12 years, we've never had a vacancy. We always had two or three people on a waiting list, and it was definitely not a blighted property by any stretch of the imagination. Well, the city of Bloomington approached me, oh, I'd say about 7, 8 years ago, and said, "Mr. Foreman, we're thinking about doing something with that corner. Would you be willing to build a different building?" And, of course, I was very happy with that particular building, but in the spirit of maybe being a good citizen, I said, "Well, yeah, I think if you would like me to build a different building, I think we could do that." So I worked with the city for a few years, talking to some of the other homeowners, convincing them that this might be a good idea, and talking to, there was a strip mall owner, and he said that he would be willing to sell. And so, having said that, it looked like the project was gonna go ahead. Did a couple of proposals. Well, long about that time, about a year and a half ago, the city informs me that, "Well, Mr. Foreman, we appreciate your effort. So I stand here before you today as a proponent for this bill because it's something that is needed, and it's very clear given what's happening to me and my family."
Thank you, Mr. Foreman. The next witness on the agenda is Mr. Dan Vang. Good afternoon, Mr. Vang. Welcome to the committee. And again, if you'd state your name for the tape, please, and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the House. Thank you for having me here today. Today is a very important day for me and my family. We have been through a lot, to say the very least. My name is Dan Vang. I represent Mr. Cha Fong Lee and the Hmong American Shopping Center. My father-in-law came to this country in 1979 with $50 in his pocket, a wife, 6 kids, and everything he owned in his back. He's a Vietnam veteran, or not Vietnam, but from Laos, a war that was for freedom in the country of Laos. He fought for the United States of America. He was one of the few that did not make it to Thailand as the first group of refugees. So he was re-educated by the communist regime that took over. There he learned that government can take anything at any time, and they do not have to have a purpose or reason for that taking. As he learned of the system, he was able to escape to Thailand and come to America, because that's where he heard and he learned that this was a land that they did not practice this kind of such actions against their own people. And on the plane ride to America, Mr. Lee asked the pilot to confirm this. The pilot responded, "If you buy land in America, it's yours." So for the next 20 years, Mr. Lee worked from the bottom line gardener to an Asian food retailer and onto a small strip mall owner, and where he named it the Hmong American Shopping Center. That was in Brooklyn Center. Today, we have learned that what that man shared with Mr. Lee on that plane ride to America, everything he shared, was not true. America does practice such actions against its people. So there's irony in this story. And why are we dealing with a situation where you're taking land from somebody when it's legally theirs and they're paying for it? Now, a year ago, I didn't know what eminent domain meant. Like most Americans, I'm educated. I went to school, graduated. I don't know what eminent domain means. Most of us don't. A lot of people here today to argue on behalf of it or against it really don't know either until you experience it. So, upon my ignorance, I go to the community director of Brooklyn Center and I ask, hey, what does that mean? The answer was, oh, it's another word for friendly taking. A year ago, I learned there's nothing friendly about eminent domain. Not one bit. 7 months ago, it marked a very dark time for our family, the Asian community, and the community of Brooklyn Center. It will be remembered, and will be as devastatingly remembered, to the Asian community as Rondo has been to the African American community. It was when the city of Brooklyn Center took our property by eminent domain. We believe this taking was and still is the largest evidence of that the power of eminent domain can and is being abused by local government, not only in Brooklyn Center, but all of Minnesota. You might ask, well, what kind of evidence do you have? Well, my evidence is not through books, but through experience. And that's what I'm going through and my family is going through right now. In court, the city of Brooklyn Center did not have a blight study. They didn't have to prove anything. They just said it was. We paid all of our taxes on time. We did not fight the city in any way, shape, or form on a development or redevelopment of our property. Instead, we worked with them, just as the fellow you heard before. We spent hundreds and thousands of dollars into this relationship and working up to a design, into a feasible concept that would be acceptable to the city so we could build it on our land. We proposed a $23 million project to the city with a concept that was accepted and approved by the council, with our family taking all of the risk. The financial risk, that is. The city of Brooklyn Center had no evidence of structural safety issues to the building. They had no violations that we did not take care of our land and our buildings as landowners. They had no reports of high crimes or any of such reports. We received awards for our community involvement into the city of Brooklyn Center. We held their Earl Brown team dance at our property, on our property, at our cost. We helped to interview the process and hiring their deputy chief. Lastly, we were financially approved for this project. Yet the city of Brooklyn Center chose to implement the power of eminent domain. As stated before, they're considering others at this time. Now keep this in mind. This is our land, not the city's. This was our land. We worked hard for it. 25 years. So you ask yourself, if you have a plan for your land, a plan that was accepted by the city and financially sound, shouldn't you have the right to build it? During the eminent domain process, the Hmong community approached the city of Brooklyn Center in a council meeting. The mayor of Brooklyn Center said, why do you bring up race when there's nothing to do with race at this time? Well, it's funny. Because when you take away the only Hmong American shopping center in the world, a centralized Asian grocery store that services not only the Brooklyn Center community, but the entire West Metro, when your city is 30% Hmong, and your home ownership is turning over by the month to our community, and when you take without repair or replacement of this, it sends a clear message what card you played and what tool you used to play. To put it very simple, let's close out all the Cubs and Rainbows around the Twin Cities and have everyone drive down to the Midway for food. Let's make it fair. All of a sudden, there's an issue. Another part of my experience has been that local leaders or leaders above our local government have very little or no idea the impact that it has on a family. Now, I've heard a lot of people talk about money. Everybody I've run through have talked to me about money and developers and blah, blah, blah. What happened to the human side of things? Let me share, you know, some things that has happened to us. And keep in mind, we work anywhere from 12 to 16-hour days. We open 365 days out of the year. We're a family-run business. We have a lot of pride doing it. Since the taking, our house is up for sale. My wife and children are no longer in Minnesota because we can no longer afford their service. They're not working at other stores. How do you explain that to your wife? How do you explain it to your parents who don't speak English? And you have to tell them, there's nothing we can do. The law does not protect us. Our financial future is unknown at this point. Our business is boxed up into trailers with an unknown future. Mr. and Mrs. Lee cannot retire and must now work harder. We have creditors pushing us down the credit process, which the city does not have to care about because it's not according to the law. We've had to use up all of our savings to fight this. We're $180,000 in, and we're just at the valuation hearing. We're a long way from the finish, folks. And this is reality. I'm disappointed that they're, with the lack of leadership, can use a tool to destroy people, to destroy something, and only to say that they have a better public purpose that's undefined with no plans in place. In our valuation hearings, it's very interesting because they came back with a number lower than what they deposited in court. And they're asking us to pay them back for taking our land. This is not hearsay. Documentation sits in my office. Anybody asks shall receive. Lastly, since the Kelo case that everybody's been mentioning, eminent domain cases have been popping up faster and more noticeable now. I have to assume that there is a loophole that people are jumping at it, trying to get their plans in. This reform that I support, that Representative Johnson has proposed, is a part of our healing process, so no other person, white, black, Asian, whatever, rich, poor, does not have to go through the anguish my family is going through right now. Because the way we look at it in this current fight and the way it currently stands, there is a fight. And right now, there's only one person with a stick. Equal the playing field. Make a decision to do the right thing and cause a reform to make sure that this kind of activity does not happen to another American family. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Bang, thank you. Some very powerful testimony. Colleagues, what we're going to do here briefly is Washington County Commissioner Dick Stafford is with us today, and he wanted to testify on the opponent side, if you will, but he has another time commitment. So what I'm going to do is briefly revert from the announced schedule and allow Commissioner Stafford a couple moments to make his remarks to the committee. Commissioner Stafford.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Keith Carlson with the Metropolitan Intercounty Association. Mr. Stafford had to leave because of his time commitment, so I would like later on the agenda to have an opportunity to make some comments on this.
Okay, so that's fine, Mr. Carlson. We'll go ahead and do that. Thank you for clarifying that. Okay, members, that concludes the witness testimony. We will take some more questions and committee discussion now in this block of time, and I know Representative Simon has been waiting. Representative Simon. Okay, thank you, Representative Simon. Any other members have discussion, questions? Representative Westrum.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, I got a question for one of the first two witnesses, the lady or Mr. McGraw or Representative Johnson. One on the public use. What exactly is changing on the public use? But the second question for maybe the witnesses. Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, at what point do we allow blight to be the excuse for a public unit to take private property for another private property? If I buy an abandoned farm place or a building that's been on the market for 5 years and it's dilapidated, why should another private use be able to come in and take it? If that's my property, it's my property. I'm just curious why we're allowing that standard to seemingly still stay in place.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Westrum, in your situation, the definition of, for example, under the blight authority, dilapidated means that not only are you in structural code violation, but you're refusing to fix it. So you'd be given the opportunity to fix it. If it falls under the definition, for example, of a public nuisance, then we have traditional police powers in the United States that says if it's a nuisance and puts someone in danger, for example, which might not be the case if it's on your own property and there's no danger to it, then this probably wouldn't kick in. The definition of abandoned property includes not being able to find the owner of the property. So if you just have a building on your own land that you're not using, and it's not a public nuisance, it's not going to fall under the definition of a public use here.
Okay. What about
Representative Westrum?
The definition of public use, are we broadening that at all or changing the standard on that, or is that going to be the same?
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative Westrum, the Minnesota Constitution requires that before any eminent domain action, there must be a public use. Mm-hmm. Today, Chapter 117 doesn't define what public use is. What this bill does is it defines public use as things like roads and bridges and schools, things owned by the public. Secondly, it defines public use as access for utilities. Thirdly, the mitigation of blight, reduction of abandoned properties, mitigation of contaminated properties, and addressing public nuisance. It is a very narrow, well-defined definition of public use, and it'll be the first time that it's been in Chapter 117.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. McGrath, I have a question along with that. How does, I don't know if this is a term of art, but substandard housing, and the reason I bring this up is I have had an opportunity to speak with some city officials and concerned citizens, for example, in areas of St. Paul and First Ring suburbs, and my understanding is that part of the housing stock in nearly every area, the older parts of the metro, could be considered dilapidated or substandard under some definitions that have been used. For example, you can find a house that perhaps was built prior to World War II that is very livable. It's kept well by the owners, but if a building inspector walked through it, would find a host of code violations that would technically make the house substandard and thus vulnerable to a taking under some definitions. Do you know anything about that? Am I on the right track with that? How does that all work within the definition?
On the right track. And what your question begs for is a clear, easily understandable, and workable definition of blight. Representative Johnson and Senator Bach's legislation does exactly that. First, it requires that a municipality cite the home or the building for a specific structural code violation. And those violations are enumerated as they relate to roofs and support walls, foundations, ventilations, fire protection, internal utilities, and flooring. Second, it improves process. The League of Cities has been terrific in advocating for process improvements. And here is one in which the homeowner has an opportunity to fix the structural building code violation. Thirdly, it caps the time that a homeowner has to fix those. And finally, it quantifies those violations as being something of significance. 75% of the tax assessed value. it's worthy to note that the municipality itself controls the tax assessed value, but still it does give protection to the homeowner through a very clear, very clean and crisp definition of what dilapidated buildings are, and that they are the things that constitute blight.
Mr. McGrath, I had a follow-up question that perhaps somewhat related, and it goes back to a question Representative Slawik had asked in terms of statistics. And much like criminal convictions, we know that there is a lot that happens in terms of plea bargaining, and I think in the same way, cases in which eminent domain is threatened but not formally used constitute a large part of what we're talking about here. And I'm wondering if you know of any data, or if you're in the process of collecting any, which can give us an idea of situations in which eminent domain is threatened to be used, but of course it doesn't go into a formal process, but of course accelerates negotiation.
Mr. Chairman, regrettably, there is no way to track the threats. And no report, the report that my colleagues at the Institute for Justice in Washington, D.C., or the report that the League of Cities has put together, includes the threat of eminent domain that provokes the so-called voluntary sale. Every number that you see underestimates the use of eminent domain because it excludes the threat component that municipalities currently use with oftentimes.
Thank you. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know, Mr. McGrath, if you could stay up there, or Representative Johnson. I think the definition of blight, the way that you have it here, is very specified towards structures, buildings. But it seems to me that the definition of blight is broader than that, and sometimes you can see blight that is not necessarily structural, but things on the property that create the appearance of blight or things like that that don't aren't satisfied within the zoning code, things like that. So where in your bill, Representative Johnson or Mr. McGrath, where in the bill do we talk about non-structural blight?
Mr. McGrath.
Representative Broad, Mr. Chairman, this bill is focused not on regulating. It is focused on taking. Municipalities can regulate. Municipalities can cite people for paint and those cosmetic and aesthetic issues that you raise. This bill takes none of their power away from addressing those important issues that improve livability in a community. This bill's focus, however, is just on the taking, the what the Supreme Court has called the despotic power, the taking of property.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then one more question, and I don't know, Mr. McGrath, if you have this, and actually it might be something that's just curious to me and nobody else, but I'm just wondering about capital gains. When a property owner gets property taken, if it's not their property that they live in, there's obviously some capital gains issues there. How is that taken into account decisions that are made, offers that are made, in negotiation? It's a little bit off topic, so it may be something that somebody just has to get me information about later.
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, in law school, I ran away from tax class with great speed. I will gladly get your answer, an answer to you and the committee about that.
Representative Johnson.
I can't answer this authoritatively, but this issue has come up, and my understanding is that there is some benefit with respect to the amount of time you have to purchase another homestead, for example. I think you get an extension of time if you sold under the threat of eminent domain.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm thinking more of the non-homesteaded properties, small business owners, businesses, things like that.
I don't know.
Okay. Representative Broad, we'll see if we can get you an answer to that. Mr. McGrath, did you want to weigh in once again on that?
Schnitger, who didn't run away in law school from tax, tells me a two-year deferral.
Okay. Does that answer your question, Representative Broad? Okay, great. Thank you. Any other questions or discussion or any of our witnesses here? Okay, seeing none, members, what we'll do then is we'll take this opportunity to take a 10-minute break. ask you to please come back in a timely fashion so we don't have people constantly filtering back in. If we could all be seated within 10 minutes, that would be a miracle, but please try. Thank you, God.
Oh, no, quite enough. I can move a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just kind of, yeah.
All right.
Not the usual spot. I'm here.
Red pill.
Nice to meet you. I'm the PowerPoint runner.
Okay.
Nora. Okay, this is the new battery runner.
Okay. Okay. Folks, could you please take your seats? We can resume.
Well, you've got a bunch.
Orderly crowd.
Real high tech.
Everybody, welcome back. If you kindly take any conversations you have out to the common areas, what we will do now is resume the committee hearing and move into a 60-minute block of time for those who are the opponents or have concerns regarding this bill. Once again, that will be a 60-minute time block divided however the opponents wish to divide that time. And, of course, in the remaining time, we will take committee discussion and committee questions. With that, the chair will recognize Mr. Steve Larson, the mayor of New Brighton. Mayor Larson, good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Steve Larson, the mayor of New Brighton, but I'm also here to speak on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities Board of Directors, which I'm a member of. I'm also vice president of the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities and President of North Metro Mayors Association. I think when we're dealing with some of the components of quality of life, there's areas that are essential to the health, vitality of our communities and our state. For, you know, family, I think we look at jobs, affordable housing, senior housing, environmental cleanup or protection, strong neighborhoods. You know, sometimes these goals cannot be fully realized without eminent domain. In Minnesota, eminent domain is used for economic development and redevelopment, and it has been for many, many years. I think we also would like to state that it's used rarely. It isn't common practice. It's used only when based on land use plan developed through public input, which I think is very important. Authority recently upheld that in the Kelo case, and involving the transfer of property from one private owner to another sometimes is necessary for the public good. It may be difficult to imagine a scenario where this type of eminent domain could serve the greater good. However, when you look at affordable housing or senior housing, virtually some of those instances are impossible for cities to facilitate without a private sector partner. Cleanup of polluted industrial sites often involves public-private partnerships, and a community's only option may be eminent domain. Evaluating situations where eminent domain may be called for, city councils work to achieve a balance, first of all, between the interests of the individual homeowner and the interests of the community at large. It's easy to say in an abstract that an individual's property rights should always outweigh job creation, but what if your community has just lost its only major employer? Where should the balance fall then? It's easy to say that individual property rights should always trump new housing, but what if your population is aging, community needs senior housing, and assisted living facilities? Should the residents then be forced to move out of your community? Or could individuals be paid just compensation for the property in order to achieve this community priority? And I emphasize the just compensation. These are very difficult questions. Compromise can be impossible to achieve. Local government officials don't seek out opportunities to use eminent domain. First of all, there's no personal or political gain to doing that, and you're surely going to be criticized for the actions. When I was elected, I took an oath to act on behalf of all of my residents and all the businesses that are in my city. To achieve our community's vision for its future was a prime directive, and I can assure you that all local officials in Minnesota take their responsibilities on this issue very seriously. You know, most support the use of eminent domain when there is evidence of compelling public benefit to be gained. Severe limits on the use of eminent domain for economic development or redevelopment threaten the ability of communities to achieve their vision. And I would say especially for older communities that don't have virgin soil that need to be redeveloped. And we're not here today in the interest of the cities as entities, but in the interest of communities of people and businesses that we serve. It is their priorities that are at stake. And then when you listen to some of my colleagues from White Bear Lake and Coon Rapids, please view their case studies not just as anecdotes. Also, I think they're representative of some of the other unique situations that have made it necessary for cities throughout Minnesota to exercise eminent domain. And I think they also will illustrate how it furthers their community economic development and redevelopment goals. And if you believe it is government's role to serve the greater good, room must be left for those rare circumstances when eminent domain is necessary to achieve that greater good. Thank you for time and attention. I'd like to now turn it over to Tom Grundhofer with the League of Minnesota Cities.
Thank you, Mayor Larson. Mr. Grundhofer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Grundhofer. I'm the General Counsel with the League of Minnesota Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to present a municipal perspective on this very important issue. As has been said here today, I want to reemphasize that the point that despite all the public outcry in response to the Kelo decision, I think it's truly a true statement that most lawyers would agree that Kelo did not create new law. It's been the law for decades, both here and nationally. This is particularly true in Minnesota, where our laws for years have authorized local governments to use the power of eminent domain to achieve legislatively authorized goals associated with development and redevelopment. When I speak about Minnesota laws, I'm referring to both court decisions and legislative enactments. I think it is imperative in this debate to remember that the legislature has explicitly permitted the use of eminent domain for a whole variety of redevelopment purposes. In particular, there is an entire chapter in the Minnesota statutes, Chapter 469, that states that it is a valid public purpose for local governments to be involved in neighborhood and business revitalization efforts, environmental cleanup initiatives, affordable housing proposals, and job creation. At least historically, the legislature has seen these as important public policy goals. With all due respect to Representative Johnson, one of the problems with this proposed legislation is that it narrowly focuses the debate on the eminent domain tool without taking into account the effect that eliminating the tool will have on the ability of governments, all governments, to accomplish these important public policy goals. As you will hear from our city representatives, a number of very important public-private projects have been furthered through the use of eminent domain. Under Representative Johnson's proposal, quite frankly, these proposals would never have been able to be accomplished. Again, we think it is important to look more explicitly at the kinds of projects that will not get done rather than simply focusing on the tool alone. Again, condemnation is never a measure that is desired, but sometimes it is a necessary one in order to provide the services that the citizens of a community might demand. With that said, I would like to make some specific comments about the proposed legislation. First, in looking at the specifics of the legislation, the irony is that while the proposed legislation comes in response to what some have criticized as an activist court, it proposes a concept that takes the tough decisions about eminent domain out of the hands of accountable public officials and puts it squarely in the hands of the court. The language clearly makes every eminent domain decision subject to judicial second-guessing and means that complex decisions about the needs of a community will be made by judges rather than local officials who live and work in the communities. I might mention that the version of the bill before you doesn't just stop at judicial second-guessing by trial courts. In Section 6 of the bill, page 4, line 30 through 32, it establishes what I would describe as an almost unprecedented level of judicial review by saying that once this matter has been heard and determined by the trial court, if it gets appealed to the Court of Appeals, it then has another de novo review. So instead of affording some deference to the local government decision-making like we do now, not only is there a trial de novo at the trial court, but there's in essence a new trial de novo review at the appellate courts. And I think that's unprecedented. Under the proposed language, local governments must prove by clear and convincing evidence that the proposed taking is necessary, serves a public purpose, and is supported by payment of just compensation. Now, while this sounds like an innocuous enough requirement, in reality, it's a Fair Employment Act for attorneys who love the opportunity to force governments to meet this heightened burden of proof, which is really only slightly lower than the beyond a reasonable doubt standard that we find in criminal cases. The changes really do not serve the interests of property owners either, because it really adds uncertainty to the development process and undermines the predictability that property owners and governments need to make long-term plans. Another problem with the bill is the way in which it responds to issues supposedly created by the Kelo decision. Rather than just addressing the concerns that have been raised by Kelo, this legislation will change the process for all land acquisition activities, including those for roads, highways, sewers, and parks. Another major concern with the bill is that it prohibits the use of eminent domain for economic development purposes, even those for which the state has encouraged the project by the use of state financial assistance. The bill, in essence, declares that government efforts to promote jobs and spur economic development are really no longer a valid public purpose. While this bill focuses on eminent domain, I think legislatures will have to be ready to respond to what almost certainly will be an attack on any government program or activity that is aimed at economic expansion. The bill would also severely handicap municipal efforts to meet the needs of residents by prohibiting efforts to revitalize distressed neighborhoods, provide affordable housing, and clean up polluted lands. Under the bill, the permitted uses of eminent domain are so narrow that municipal efforts in this area would be effectively shut down, and I'm not overstating that. For example, in Section 2, on page 3, lines 18 through 25 of the bill, it is clear that local governments could not take non-dilapidated property or non-contaminated property within an otherwise blighted area, even if the area itself is blighted, unless the local government can show that it is absolutely necessary in order to remove the dilapidated buildings or to complete remediation of the entire area. As Representative Lesch pointed out before, I do not believe Mr. McGrath's explanation of that provision is accurate. The plain wording is that unless the property itself is dilapidated or contaminated, you cannot take that, even if surrounding properties are dilapidated or contaminated. The final major concern with the bill involves the way in which it changes how compensation is determined. At a time when public budgets are already tight, the law makes it all types of acquisitions more expensive and subject to litigation by providing for award of attorney's fees and providing for a speculative element of damages known as loss of going concern.
current law already allows loss of going concern damages. But what this bill does is completely flip-flop the burden of proof, saying that absolutely it's an entitlement to every business owner unless the local government can prove by clear and convincing evidence that they're not entitled to it. Again, it's totally an unachievable burden that's being placed on local governments and will clearly increase the cost of all takings. With that, I'll end my comments. I'm going to turn it over to Louis Jamboy, Executive Director of the Association of Minnesota, Association of Metropolitan Municipalities.
Thank you, Mr. Grundhofer. Good afternoon, Mr. Jamboy. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Again, my name is Louis Jamboy. I'm the Executive Director of the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities, and I appreciate the opportunity to address you today. As Tom Grundhofer had indicated, the Kelo case didn't change Minnesota law. But at issue is eminent domain for economic development. And what that is, of course, is the non-voluntary acquisition for a subsequent private use. The public response to the Kelo decision suggests that discussion of eminent domain is very appropriate, and we're grateful for that discussion. But we're here to tell you that there are two sides to every story. At the heart of the Kelo's determination is blight, a determination of blight. Most eminent domain in the Twin Cities area is conducted for redevelopment activities in the fully developed area. In 17 cases, it was in the core cities or the inner ring suburbs. Five more cases are in older metro cities where urban development has made them suburbs now. All were blight-related. These cities have been characterized as eminent domain abusers. We're providing some examples to you today and in the future of blight. We believe these are very legitimate examples, and more importantly, we believe so far in the discussion of eminent domain, we've lost a very crucial point, and that point is the impact that blighted property has on adjacent private property in that area. The impact that these blighted sites have on the investments of other Minnesota taxpayers who also have rights. Very quickly, in the city of Robbinsdale, condemned a house. The owners had died. The heirs didn't want to sell. The water pipes froze, burst, flooded the basement, damaged the main floor, cracked the foundation, ruined the furnace, the water heater, and mold invaded the home. The city tried to negotiate. The owners didn't want to sell. The city condemned. The commissioners awarded $130,000 for a dilapidated house. The average price for a home sale in the city of Robbinsdale in 2002 was $164,000. The neighbors were delighted. Several thanked the city for taking action to protect their property values. Several neighbors, after the condemnation, made substantial improvements in their own homes. With the removal of that property, they felt empowered to make improvements to their own property. In the city of Columbia Heights, is a 30-acre industrial site that was seriously contaminated. Solvents, petroleum, and other chemicals, and cleanup was a high priority of the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development, the Met Council, and the Pollution Control Agency. The cleanup cost was over $4.5 million. Some of those buildings were still in use. Others were vacant. The businesses that were viable businesses were relocated and are still operating. In the place of that industrial area is 550 new housing units, 1,200 new residents and customers for local businesses. The neighbors, again, in that neighborhood were delighted. This 30-acre industrial site was in a residential area, as many old industrial sites are in the developed part of the Twin Cities. We have many more cases, and in subsequent testimony here and in subsequent hearings, we're going to bring those out. We've distributed information to you today on the Brooklyn Center case, for instance, and Champlin City Manager Brett Heitkamp and Mayor Stephen Boynton are here today, and they hope to be able to address you on the Champlin issue as well. With the many more cases, we're going to tell those stories through data and through pictures. We want to show you some of the blight. We want to take this out of the abstract and the academic, and we want to show you what we're talking about. And then we're going to ask you four simple questions. First, do you want your home or business next to this blight? What impact do these blighted properties have on the value of your property and your neighbor's property? Does government have a role in protecting the value of your property from blight? And if not, how do you protect the value of that property? We've heard that even one so-called eminent domain abuse is too many. But if we go too far with a fix, we could be sacrificing the property rights and the property values of many in order to protect one or two. We know that Representative Johnson's proposal includes a blight exclusion, but the blight definition in concert with other provisions goes too far. We don't think it will be an impediment to redevelopment. We think it will end redevelopment. Tom Grundhofer identified the specific problems, so I won't repeat them again. But I want to remind everyone that the Kelo case created an uproar, but this current bill goes way beyond Kelo. Kelo was a private-to-private for economic development. It was a claim of policy creep. We believe the current bill that's being discussed today affects all eminent domain takings, not just private-to-private, but traditional eminent domain as well, and we think it's a solution creep. I'll close by saying that eminent domain is used sparingly in the Twin Cities metropolitan area and is used mostly for blight. So why do we need such a comprehensive eminent domain bill? Well, we don't. We need it, we think, because so-called eminent domain abuse has been overstated. And we're in serious danger of passing an overreaching eminent domain bill based on an eminent domain overstated problem. If it passes, it'll cost the taxpayers, your constituents, all of them, more money for public projects and public services, and it'll sacrifice the rights, the property rights, of those residents who have invested in and continually maintain their private properties. We think we've got a better idea, and we'd like to share that with you at this time or at a later time. Mark Sather will be on next from the city of White Bear Lake. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's correct. Mr. Sather, you're up next, and then members after that, we have Mayor Howe from Coon Rapids, Mr. Thiessen from the County Engineers. Excuse me, after Mayor Howe, we'll have Mayor Boynton come in from Champlin, then Mr. Thiessen, and then Mr. Carlson on behalf of Commissioner Stafford. Mr. Sather, good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mark Sather. I'm the city manager in White Bear Lake. And I'd like to present a case study of redevelopment in White Bear Lake that involved the use of eminent domain to assist you in dealing with this difficult issue. Just a little bit of background on White Bear Lake. This year, it will celebrate its 125th anniversary as an incorporated city. It's been a community along a railroad line and along a lake for almost 150 years. And it is one of the suburbs in the Twin Cities that's blessed with a historic downtown that adds a great deal of pride and sense of community to its residents. In 1986, there was increasing concern about the condition of an area adjacent to its downtown in Highway 61. The area was approximately 6 blocks in length and about a block in depth. The primary use of this property was the remaining segment of the former rail line that connected St. Paul with Duluth. The property adjacent to the rail line that had several metal-clad buildings that were previously served by the railroad, but the businesses that at that time occupied those structures no longer relied on the rail, and the rail was becoming increasingly less of a service provider in that area. There were less frequent deliveries. Other uses included oil storage tanks, an unused depot, several commercial structures, and several single-family homes. The problem was the fact that there was an increasing amount of illegal dumping. We eventually found pollution on the site, actual oil contamination and other chemicals. And there was growing concern in the community about that condition. At the same time, several other initiatives of the city in a planning area, I think we have some pictures here, I'm sorry I haven't been focusing, but these are showing some of the pictures of the structures that were there. There was concern about the downtown, increasing competition from regional malls, and the fact that it, while it had a great deal of quality remaining for the city, it was not sufficient in size to be the destination it needed to be to survive. The planning initiatives at the time also identified our city as in great need of senior citizen housing. We had several people who, or several of our residents who were prepared to move from their single-family homes, turn them over to younger families, but there was little or no senior citizen housing in the community. Several of the businesses that were on this property actually only leased their land from the railroad, and they owned their structure. They had a 30-day lease or 30-day notice for cancellation in their lease clause with the railroad. This condition provided no encouragement or incentive for reinvestment or repair of the buildings, and it became increasingly dilapidated. There, again, the condition of those buildings also became somewhat of an attractive nuisance for illegal dumping, and this became a growing problem for the city. There was encouragement by several groups in the city, including the Chamber of Commerce, the Planning Commission, and other civic interest groups for some leadership from City Hall to lead for the redevelopment of that area. The City Council did, and in your packet, I think there's better summary perhaps than what we have, or they have time for now. But overall, the city, the redevelopment of this six-block segment involved the acquisition of 32 different parcels, including 9 businesses. We're happy to report of all those businesses, of 9 that were acquired, 8 of them remain in our city. One, we believe, was basically a casualty of changing retail. It was a small confectionery sales business that basically found businesses such as Sam's Club sold for less than them. The individual chose to take our acquisition dollars and retire. The other businesses, all of whom were in leased buildings along that area, now are in at least properties but owned buildings, remain in our city in properties that they now own as a result of being able to take the acquisition and relocation dollars that were presented by the city. I want to point out that White Bear Lake City Council interpreted the Uniform Land Acquisition and Relocation Act to apply to all acquisitions by the city. So regardless of whether, if in fact the city initiated the effort to purchase the property, we anticipated and offered relocation benefits. This project actually took place over several years in 4 different phases. And many of the properties that were acquired through contact from the owners of the property to the city. When they knew that we were making this effort, a number of the, particularly the single-family homeowners, came to the City Hall and asked if we would acquire their property. Because we were doing it in phases, in many instances, we were not even prepared to buy the property yet, but the City Council took the position that because we had designated this as a redevelopment district, there was a certain ominous threat that eventually the city's going to come and potentially use eminent domain to acquire our property. So maybe we should use this opportunity to find another place to move. Now, how that works for a lot of people, keep in mind you can see the condition of some of these houses. When they came to the City Hall, the city offered to we gave them money for an appraisal. We had their property appraised. We gave them a copy of our appraisal and offered them a minimum of the appraised value. In some instances, they would show us their appraisal, which generally maybe was within 5 or 10% of our appraisal. And the city council's policy was to basically offer the difference. And in each of those cases, each of the cases I'm referring to now, other than the three I'm going to summarize quickly here in a moment, we were able to acquire the property that way. The homeowners took that payment as well as relocation benefits that they were entitled to and moved to another home. The three that I want to talk about, I think, are most important to the topic today. One, we needed to straighten out a road. And in doing so, we needed to purchase a piece of land that was owned by a private property owner, a bar, and it was part of its parking lot. They had about 57 stalls. I don't have my notes on that, so I'm estimating that at this point. And we were going to acquire about 7 of those. Part of the redevelopment project was to build a municipal parking lot immediately adjacent to this bar on the other side that would be purchased and built by the city, maintained without assessments, for open public parking. We felt that was a great deal for the owner. We would acquire his 7 stalls, provide a 50-stall parking lot immediately adjacent. That parking lot, most of those stalls were closer to his front door than the ones that we were purchasing. This seemed to be an easy purchase, and yet the owner said no. And we found out through the process that he was not particularly concerned about that, but was concerned about the likely competition that would come from a retail building that was going to be constructed next to him. He had a bar that one of the primary occupants of the new building was going to be a bar and restaurant. And he felt that the competition from that new bar would be unreasonable, and he opposed our acquisition primarily on that purpose. The city council chose to go ahead with eminent domain. We went through the process. I'm sure most of you know how that works, but basically a three-person panel is appointed, went through. We made our arguments based on what we thought the severance value of those stalls were, and he made his arguments. The settlement was made. It came in much higher than what the city thought, but we were prepared to make payment in that matter. The individual appealed that, and in the course of preparing for that legislation, made an offer that based on his argument that there would be such severe damage from that new building coming next to his that it was a total taking. In other words, we needed to buy the entire bar, the business, all the inventory and so forth. The city council chose to do so. And subsequently, the individual they bought it from asked to be able to lease it back initially for 9 months, which we granted. He then extended that for 2 years, which we granted. He then came in and requested that we transfer that lease to his son, who today continues to lease the building back. The city is now at the point of trying to decide, should we continue our redevelopment effort with that structure or sell it back to him? But I'm here to say, and I know that if that owner was here to say, his business is stronger now than it was before the initial acquisition. So the fear of this business coming in and taking it really wasn't founded, but the city understood that fear and made that compensation payment to him. The next one, and I'm considerate of your time, so I'm going to try to move on a little faster, but the city acquired several houses. And in each case, as I mentioned before, the individuals came forward and in many of the cases and said, I'm prepared to sell my house. We arrived at a price that generally, in most cases, we were like $3,000 or $4,000 apart in terms of our two appraisals, so it was easy to reach a settlement. We handled all the closing costs. There was no real estate commissions and so forth, so I think most of these homeowners felt that this was a pretty good way of selling their home. We had one individual who owned a home, and he rented it out. It was a rental property for him. We made him an offer. In fact, he was the last one, and the last of the single-family homes, second to the last single-family home that we had to acquire. And he came with a very unique argument, we thought. He felt that he had the right to be the last person, and that if it wasn't for the city, the developer would have to pay him considerably more than the value of the property. And through the course of our negotiations, he admitted that we had offered him more than his own appraisal of the value. But he said that value was based on generally accepted appraisal principles. And yet it was overlooking the fact that when multiple parcels were acquired, If he could be the last one, he could easily ask for, and did, more than twice the appraised value of the property. The city council decided to use eminent domain in that particular case because they felt it was the only way to be fair to all the other people who had offered their property or agreed to sell their property for something very close to what was the combined appraised value. The city basically ended up increasing its offer by about 10% to avoid the cost of eminent domain, and the individual eventually accepted that. So I would say in our report there might be a misstatement here that he objected it in principle because he believed that there was a right to be the last parcel. The final one is one that I hope you'll actually consider closely because I work for and I have worked in the state of Minnesota for locally elected officials for 32 years. And I find them to be as concerned about individuals and individual rights as I'm sure you are. And they are very close to their residents. The fourth and final phase of this redevelopment project involved the construction of 80 unit senior citizen housing complex. We had to acquire, I believe, four houses for that particular project, and the last one was owned by, I believe, at that time probably late 80s, early 90s, year old female resident of our community. She did not want to sell. She actually had a house and several additional structures, garages and storage sheds and so forth. She did not want to sell. And we offered her the appraised value. She did not want to sell. We offered more of the appraised value. She did not want to sell. We had a single family lot a block and a half away that we offered to pick her house up, move it. It was a house of probably, there's a picture of it. It was about, I think the house was close to 70 years old. She had strong emotional attachment to that house. Her husband built it. And yet the foundation was falling. It had an insufficient heating and mechanical system, electrical system, and so forth. So we offered to actually move the house to about a block and a half away, put on a new foundation, new furnace, new electrical, and everything. And Mrs. Letourneau said, no, I don't want to move. And we were under an agreement with the developer to attempt to make reasonable attempts to acquire the property. We were not committed to use eminent domain, but we were committed to make reasonable attempts to acquire the property. The city council found a dilemma. They did not want to take this woman's property against her will. So we eventually sat down and negotiated a settlement with her where we acquired all the remote buildings on her property, basically paid her for all of that land plus those structures, severed off enough for her house, and basically built the apartment complex around it. Some of our other negotiations that was actually to provide her a very low rate, a beautiful unit in this senior citizen apartment complex that was closest to her home. She still didn't want to do that. She felt that the settlement that we reached was fair. And I know the city council did. And I know they were relieved to be able to say that they made this effort and they reached an amenable solution. Now, in the back of my mind, would they have ever used eminent domain? I seriously doubt in that case. But you could see, I think, through some of these, the complexity of pulling together 32 different parcels like this. It's very, very difficult. This development, we have the notes, but what resulted is we have five new commercial buildings, anywhere from one to three stories. We have 80-unit senior apartment. We restored a historical depot, a railroad depot. We have 28 new businesses, and I don't know how many jobs were created by those, but it's certainly in the hundreds. It's a very thriving part of our downtown. We've added a great deal of retail space. White Bear Lake, as I said, is celebrating its 125th anniversary, and we're very proud that we still have one of the few remaining downtowns. We were a city long before we were a suburb, and I believe the community is very proud of this project. And without the redevelopment tools that cities have, This would not have happened. And so we ask for your consideration of the complexities of those as you work through this this difficult decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sather. Mayor Howe.
afternoon, Mr. Chair, Committee. Thank you for having me here this afternoon and letting me the opportunity to tell the Coon Rapids story and its use of eminent domain.
Mr. Howell, can I just have you identify yourself for the tape, please?
My name is Tim Howell, Mayor of the City of Coon Rapids.
Thank you.
To do about Coon Rapids Boulevard. This was the main route in our city. Now, we didn't really have a main street, but it was the main route. And Highway 10 was built a mile or so up in the 70s. Over time, the businesses, the post office, the banks, the medical clinics, three car dealerships, box stores, small businesses, and even City Hall moved out toward the new highway. For the most part, it was a market demographic-based migration. It wasn't something we did as a city, we believed, to force it. It just is something that the businesses saw, and looking at the numbers, that's where they needed to go. We were left with closed businesses, vacant stores, and many of the new businesses that did take up residence in these buildings were what I'd classify as less than desirable. And in fact, we saw increased crime and vandalism. Frankly, on our boulevard, we were on a path to destruction. Three separate committees of staff members, neighborhood businesses, property owners, and citizens started in the middle 80s to analyze and reanalyze our boulevard situation. We finally settled on a four-port development proposal, and I don't know if the pictures are matching, but I'll just go on. You'll see them, I think, as they come up. In the late 90s, to redevelop and revitalize the boulevard. It was an intensive, expensive proposition. We have recently completed, and I want to make this clear, the first port property acquisitions. We still have three more to go, so this is an important issue for us in the city of Coon Rapids. Some of the challenges we encountered included groundwater cleanups, major ones, in many different groundwater contaminations, title issues, assemblies of the site, relocation of businesses, renters, homeowners, etc. The demolition is now complete on the first port, and we are presently finalizing the plans for a new development of combination of housing and limited market-driven commercial. This could not happen without the tool of eminent domain. It could not have happened. The impetus and incentive to move forward and improve our community would not have existed. Private development was looked at. They shook their heads at it. It was not an option. Ultimately, we utilized eminent domain and condemnation proceedings on a majority of the 22 properties in the port. We continued with our negotiations throughout the process, with ultimately three of the properties and three of the lease agreements with businesses that were in the shopping malls going to the process of a commissioner award. Can eminent domain be abused and misused by local governments? That's possible. Is it a reality in a majority of the cases? I do not believe it is at all. Is it a useful tool for local governments to act on behalf of their citizens as a whole and to improve our quality of their cities? I think we're an example of that. I think White Bear Lake's an example of that. It definitely can. The popular current political position is to bash eminent domain. Examples of questionable use, stories of long-term comp plans proposing to take individuals' homes, successful businesses being moved out. But please consider a major part of its uses. As you move forward, consider the good that it can do. Removal of deteriorated, disinvested, contaminated, blighted properties, transform to make a better community and turn a better state. I hope you have the courage to rein in the bandwagon a little bit in this situation and look at the long-term implications that are being proposed. They may sound far-reaching. I think in a lot of cases they're short-sighted. Having said all this, I want to make it clear that the project that we did, and in looking at the proposed bill that we received today as we sat back here, and I have with me our city planner from the city of Coon Rapids who's extensively on this project, we could not have done what we've done in the city of Coon Rapids, and we would not be able to move forward in the future. And that'd be a shame, because this, I think 99% of the people in the city of Coon Rapids are finally glad to see that we're able to move forward. I thank you for your time, and at this time, I believe Mayor Steve Boyden would like to come forward.
Thank you, Mayor Howell. Mayor Boyden, good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the tape, please, and then proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Steve Boynton. I'm the mayor of Champlin. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you this afternoon. Like some of the speakers before me, I also believe that there are responsible ways to use eminent domain, and I think there are irresponsible ways to use it as well. I think if the power goes unchecked, there's the ability to actually abuse that power. The reason I'm here before you today, however, something completely different. As Louis Jamboy stated earlier, I also believe that the at least perceived problem of eminent domain abuse has, at the outset of this discussion, been somewhat overstated, and most particularly in the circumstance of the city of Champlin. If this legislation is to truly be born of principle and not of anecdote, then I think the discussion at the outset needs to be factual, principled, and not merely anecdotal. In an op-ed piece that appeared in the Star and Tribune on January 6th of this year, Senator Bach and Representative Johnson cited Champlin as the poster child for eminent domain abuse. In the media in the last 2 weeks, Jim and Bev Mead, who I've known for 30 years in my community, have been trotted out to tell a story of eminent domain abuse. I want it known on the record today that in the 36-year history of Champlin, since we became a community and a city in 1971, never once have we used the power of eminent domain for any purpose, and never once has it been threatened. Those are the facts, and frankly, it disturbs me greatly when I see neighbors of mine that I've known for that period of time used in the fashion that they've been used to try and foster a debate and put a local face on this discussion. My hope is simply this. This is a fundamental right. It is a fundamental civil liberty of all of us. It deserves the attention and debate that you are giving it. I applaud each and every one of you for engaging in that debate. All I ask is that the discussion be as principled as you hope the law will ultimately be. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. Next we'll go to Mr. Thiessen from the Minnesota County Engineer.
Mr. Chairman, if it pleases you and the committee, if Mr. Thiessen and I could reverse orders, I'll make some general comments, and then Mr. Thiessen will go into some specifics.
Certainly. Mr. Carlson, if you'd identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, committee members, for giving us an opportunity to let you know of other entities' concerns about this legislation. Despite the chair's desire to have this hearing focused on economic development and the use of eminent domain for those purposes, I can't let you leave this hearing tonight believing that this bill only affects the use of eminent domain for economic development. It does not. Over half the provisions of this bill affect the use of eminent domain by any entity that's empowered to use it in Minnesota currently. That includes counties, the state, townships, school districts, public utilities, and railroads, in addition to cities. Please don't believe that this will only impact the so-called private-to-private transactions that were the so-called concern of the Kelo. If your concern is, in fact, the use of eminent domain for economic development, then I encourage you strongly to focus your work on that specific issue. You could easily attain that by jettisoning half this bill. If this bill is put into effect, it will substantially affect the amount of time and the cost for a number of traditional public use projects. If you're a farmer, if you're an environmental advocate who's concerned about the development of wind energy, which needs the construction of new transmission lines from where the power is generated to where it's used, primarily the Twin Cities, then this bill, if it was put into effect without being altered, will increase the cost and time to get those projects online. If you are a resident of northern Anoka County who's concerned about traffic congestion and the inadequate roads that serve you right now, this bill will increase the amount of time and the cost to build new roads to serve the growing community that exists out here. If you're a business person or a homeowner who's concerned about adequate energy in the future and believes, as the industry does, that new pipelines have to be built to the Twin Cities area to serve the growing energy demand of this community, this bill would cause the cost and time to put in those pipelines substantially, because, again, it not only affects cities, it also affects the public utilities that currently have the right of eminent domain and surely would use it to build those facilities. Finally, if you're or a couple more examples, if you're a farmer or a business person who's trying to develop a new ethanol facility in greater Minnesota, in many instances, it's likely you would have to use eminent domain to acquire the additional land if you're building onto an existing facility for those. And this bill would increase the cost of that and the time that it would take to build the facility. Finally, if you're a low-income individual who's concerned about adequate housing, again, the assembly of land necessary to build those new, more modern residences would take additional time and additional costs under this bill. So again, don't go out of this hearing believing that it just affects economic development or private to private. It affects every potential use of eminent domain in the state. Another fallacy that I don't want you to go here believing is that somehow this bill would result in new compensation to the owners whose property is subject to eminent domain. But largely the parties that will benefit from this legislation are third parties, primarily attorneys. Furthermore, as I think has already been inferred, the additional expense and time will affect taxpayers who will pay higher costs for the acquisition of these properties and the public at large who will suffer the effects of the delays of those properties. I do want to first commend the author for, you know, raising the subject and point out that I think there are some good things in this bill. The provisions on the public hearings, the requirements that an elected body must make the determination to go forward with eminent domain, I think is a good one in general. I think there can be some craftsmanship that is involved in enhancing that provision, but I commend that provision. I'd also suggest that there could be some other enhancements. I was party to changes that were made in the law a few years ago with regards to transportation-related acquisitions, where the law requires that we make a good faith attempt to negotiate with the individual before we attempt to acquire his or her property, and also that we explicitly share our appraisal with them before we initiate eminent domain proceedings. Right now, that requirement only exists for transportation-related developments. I would commend the same sort of proposition to eminent domain in general. Finally, again, along the lines of the hearings area, right now the HRAs, if your concern is economic development, do have to go through a hearing process before they do an acquisition. I would certainly suggest that those sort of things also apply to the other economic development entities, such as the port authorities and the EDAs. With that, I have some further specific concerns, but I think we'll leave that to a future hearing. But I would like to give Mr. Tyson an opportunity to tell you the effects specifically of one provisions on acquisitions of right-of-way for highway developments.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. We'll move to Mr. Tyson. Members, that is the last witness, and then we will move back to the question-discussion portion of the hearing. Here I already have Representative Emmer, Representatives Nelson and Broad as well, waiting to ask questions. Mr. Tyson, good afternoon. Identify yourself for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Don Tyson. I'm the Washington County Engineer. I'm also Secretary of our Minnesota County Engineers Association, so I'm speaking today on behalf of all 87 Minnesota County Engineers. I've been working as a county engineer for 19 years. Started in Representative Nelson's district, Chisago County, as their county engineer. I've personally sat in kitchens out in farmhouses. I've sat in living rooms, negotiated with small business owners. I've sat in corporate attorney offices, and I've sat in courtrooms working on this issue. The land we buy is for parks, highways, government buildings. We've helped acquire land for utilities. We've advised on the purchase of land for schools. All tremendous public purposes I think we would agree to. I'd also tell you that buying land from Minnesota landowners is one of the most difficult aspects of our job. We're constantly trying to balance what's fair for that property owner versus what's fair for those taxpayers that we also represent, the residents of our community. I want to share with you my observations on the actual impact this bill will have on the acquisition process. Others have spoken on different concerns, so I am focusing on the attorney's fees provision. Before 2003, the maximum reimbursement for an appraisal was $500. When I was sat in a bedroom or a living room negotiating right away with a person and informed them that we have to provide you another $500 for an appraisal, the usual response was, on a small taking, why don't you just increase your offer $500 and we'll settle? Now, what would you do? Is that good public policy? Is that fair representation to the other owners, the other property owners in your county? You settled because you just want to avoid prolonging the acquisition? The law was changed in 2003 to $1,500. I can tell you now what the usual answer is from people on our smaller takings. Well, just increase your offer $1,500 and we'll settle. Skip the appraisal. How do we answer the taxpayers that show up at our truth and taxation hearings about that? Why we're settling for these properties this way? In the past on this issue, Wisconsin's been touted as a model for us to follow in paying attorney's fees. I've talked to county engineers in Wisconsin and how the process works for paying attorney's fees. The answer I got is they don't pay them. They don't pay them because what they do is they just settle to avoid paying the attorney's fees and reduce their costs. Is that good public policy? In fact, one county engineer has told me they've actually now had to appear before their state legislature and answer questions about why are their acquisition costs so high. In Wisconsin, once the threshold for paying attorney fees has been reached, it's added as much as 22% to the acquisition costs. In Florida, which has one of the most liberal attorney fees provisions, the last 10 years, landowner, lawyer, and expert fees have been 21% of acquisition costs. The last 19 years, I would tell you, the highway department that I've managed, we typically settle on 95% of the cases. We don't need to use eminent domain. In Florida, where they have attorney fees, the last 10 years, the average has been 53% to 69% range. So involving attorneys in the process has not provided more or rapidly better settlements. On a dollar figure, the last 10 years, Minnesota County Highway Departments, just on our state aid system, have spent $226 million on right-of-way. That doesn't include road on right-of-way on county roads. So a conservative estimate would be about $300 million. Just a 10% increase in those costs would have been a $30 million increase in our public transportation costs. And you all know that money's not there. So this isn't going to delay projects. This is going to stop projects. On the provision of paying attorney fees if the final payment is more than 20% of our last offer, no landowner is going to accept an offer that's less than 20% than our last offer once an attorney is employed. It goes back to what I said even when it was back to $500. There's just no way that they will accept an offer less than that because then they know they'll have to pay for those fees. This language also precludes us from reaching a settlement with a landowner to not pay those attorney fees or pay it less. The law specifically says you must pay those. The eminent domain proceeding also takes time. Sometimes it can be years before a final settlement is made. Just land valuation increases alone will be more than 20% than our last offer, especially in fast-growing counties around the metro area. The net effect is we're going to be forced to rush negotiations and settlements. At the same time, its landowners are going to have an incentive not to settle, and the increased cost we pay is only going to go to experts and attorneys. Only poor results are going to come out of this situation. I appreciate your listening to our comments today. The bill as drafted is only going to increase our public improvement costs, delay or stop projects, and make the process even more confrontational. It's not a good bill for the average Minnesotan who wants to drive good roads, visit quality parks, have good schools, dependable sewer and water, electricity when they turn on their light switch, or schools that are located close to them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tyson. Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know how you want to handle it. I have two questions for two different witnesses and then a comment. You want me just to address the witness that I'm questioning?
Yeah. Just if you want to address the witnesses, they'll come up to the podium then and respond to your question.
I have a question for the Honorable Mayor of New Brighton, Mr. Larson. In your presentation, there was one thing, I don't hide anything. I'll play my cards. It troubled me. The one statement that you made that troubled me, I wrote down. You said the transfer from one private property owner to another is sometimes good. Can you give me an example from either the city of New Brighton where that's occurred and you think it was a good arrangement where the government basically took from one private party to give to another? And if you don't have an example...
Oh, I have a clear one. Okay, we just went through this.
Mayor Larson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer. A classic example is the Midwest Asphalt. I don't know if you're aware of that procedure. We were going to go through eminent domain. We ended up settling for a substantial amount of money, including going concern. In that process, we have about 20, 25, 26 acres of land that housed a non-conforming use of an asphalt company with contaminated soils. And what we needed to do is figure out a way to stop that use, get in there and clean it up, because within 600 to 700 feet is a lake in our community. We knew that the groundwater on the site was polluted. So at that point in time, we made the decision, we have to stop this operation. We have to go in there and figure out a way, as stewards of our community and of our whole region, because who knows where the contamination is going to go from an old refinery, and the residual from the chipped pieces of bituminous being exposed to rainwater. And at that point in time, we decided to take on that whole project, and that was difficult. It lasted a long time, and we've been talking about it for 15 years, but we finally did it. And we're going to clean that soil up. We bought a lot of the clean fill from this asphalt company and paid them basically an arm and a leg to do it. And what we're doing is taking that, cleaning up the soil. We're going to then sell it back to two housing developers, Rotland, and we got David Bernard and Sherman as joint owners that will assume possession of land once it is cleaned. And as soon as it's clean, we're going to put about 700 units of housing on clean soil that is no longer contaminated. That is one of the best examples I can give you.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Emmer.
Your Honor, so then in this situation, I just want to be clear. You didn't actually, did you, as Mr. Sather has described, in his situation, we had an honest threat of eminent domain, and that precipitated the property owners negotiating.
Yes.
Is that the situation?
For the mediator, yes.
So that you is didn't correct. Go actually.
We
go
didn't have to go, no. No, the mediator said, you guys have to settle. This is what I think would be a fair price, including the going concern. And we said, yes, we'll do it.
So in the end...
Representative Emmer.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman. In the end, Your Honor, you had a willing seller and a willing buyer is what you ended up
with. That is correct.
Mayor Larson.
Well, just a friendly reminder. Senate Ego is a guy. There's no question that people will listen to this tape for long after this committee hearing today. I just want to ensure that it's easy for them to put on the headphones and follow who's saying what. That's my only concern.
My apologies, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Your Honor. My next question is actually for the League of Minnesota's counsel, the capable Tom Grundhofer. You had made reference, Mr. Grundhofer, about the high standard, the clear and convincing standard that this proposal includes. And I thought you made an important distinction. Now, I know you didn't support the bill, and you're not here to tell us that any part of the bill should be passed, but in the event there is some type of modification of our eminent domain laws as they currently exist, it seems to me, as I get into this, that it's the public use issue that troubles my constituents most. I'm fortunate because the district that I represent, and being a council member for about 10 years before I came to the legislature, when eminent domain was used, it was rare and there weren't abuses. But it's not the whole forest that we're concerned with. It's just a couple of the trees that seem to be causing the problem. If we're talking about roads, utilities, parks, that there is no question that they are public uses, would you propose on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities that the standard, that there could be a workable way where the standard could be adjusted for those situations?
Mr. Grundhofer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I like your description of we're not trying to take on the forest, but we're trying to deal with this with the particular trees. The problem is this bill does deal with the forest. It deals with a set of standard, a rule of law that applies to everything, every condemnation matter. The problem with applying something like clear and convincing evidence, for instance, to the question of necessity for a road, for instance. I mean, whose opinion about whether, you know, a road is clear and convincingly necessary? The way this bill has it, it's going to be the judge now, not the local government officials who are making the decision for the road. I'm not sure that addresses your specific question, Representative Emmer, but...
Representative Emmer.
It actually opens up, thank you, Mr. Chairman, it opens up a whole new can of worms about the presentation is not necessarily, the process doesn't start with the judge. It actually starts with the property owner who's not willing to just give their property up. Maybe it's something we can talk about further. And then, Mr. Chairman, if you would.
Representative Emmer.
I'm going to make a statement for Mr. Thiessen because I feel compelled. I mean, I know it's really easy to take shots at the lawyers on these things, but perhaps I can suggest to you, sir, that if the valuations were proper, if they were not being abused, maybe the lawyers wouldn't have such an opportunity to get involved and help people that clearly are not as sophisticated as the government that's trying to exercise its rights of taking of private property. So I do think that there is a place for lawyers, and I don't know that it's quite fair to attack the legal profession for actually trying to help people against this big machine of government.
Mr. Thiessen, we'll give you a brief answer, and then we're going to move on to Representative Nelson here. I am mindful of the clock.
Mr. Emmer, I appreciate the comment. My comments were not directed at the profession. My point was is that in a fast-growing county like Washington County, the valuation literally changes every day. We'll do an appraisal at the beginning of the process. It could be a year. It could be 2 years sometimes before a commissioner's hearing. And we actually stay quite flexible when those commissioner hearings happen and try to work with the property owner on that. We will do a new appraisal, but the way the law, this bill is drafted, our last written offer, which could be 2 years before the commissioner's hearing, that valuation is obviously changing 2 years. We recognize that now in the current process. So that is the concern. The valuations, we believe, that's the concern with her. When you lock us in at the last final offer, it'll be very easy to get 20% more than that just because of the time. So my comments about needing to speed things up, if we know we give more and more time for the process, those valuations are automatically going to go above the 20%. You can see how then suddenly government's going to appear like we want to rush things along because we want to get a decision before those valuations continue to rise.
Thank you, Mr. Tyson. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I might have a couple of comments on the day's events. And not picking on anybody, but just picking a few out. We received a letter on the letterhead of the city of Champlin, and Mayor Boughton stated that no threats were used, and the letter finishes off, and it certainly does not apologize for threats that it has never made. I appreciate that, but coming from city government before being in the state legislature, including serving as a mayor of a city, I think everybody understands that sometimes threats don't have to be actually verbally made, that just because the opportunity is there, it's implied. I also have some trepidations about, for some of us insomniacs, that when we get up in the middle of the night and we turn something on the television, that we may see, and no disrespect to the attorney profession, because Lord knows there's plenty of them in this room today, of which I'm not one of. You know, I'm just a meathead, you know, I'm just a butcher. But I can just see, you know, late at night on television where some attorney is making some pledge, you know, I'll get you 20% more or you pay nothing, those types of claims. I fear that jacking up the price of some of these things. Mr. Jamboy, I would appreciate myself a copy of some of the statistics that you quoted in the first couple paragraphs of your presentation. And then for Mr. Grundhofer and or Mr. Jamboy, understanding that you folks are listed under the opponents of this bill, and quite a few others followed, I guess I want to have you verify that in fact this is a true statement that I'm going to make, that you do agree that there is room for reform in this area of eminent domain, and that in fact that to reiterate what I think I heard you say, that you're willing to work very hard with the state legislature to get some reform in this area.
Mr. Grundhofer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, yes, we are very willing to work. As a matter of fact, if we had time today, I was prepared to outline some proposals that we were going to make and that we will be bringing forward to the legislature on ways that this whole process could be reformed. I can tell you, though, the major thrust of it will be dealing with perceived problems that came out of the Kelo decision, not a uniform change to all of eminent domain law.
Mr. Jamboy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson. Yes, we definitely want to work with the legislature. We have been in many of your offices talking about eminent domain and changes to the law. We also want to work with the Institute of Justice and the auto dealers. It's both something that we want to do and something that several of your colleagues have told us that we must do, and we take that at face value. So as we proceed, we will continue to work with you. We want to work with others. We're just hoping to slow down what seemed to be a runaway train, and as a result, we are spending some serious time going through line by line, point by point, the eminent domain bills that have come to our attention. But we absolutely want to work with the legislature and with interested parties.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, and again, coming from my base in city government, coming from a county who has a commercial industrial tax base of a little under 5% against the state average of a little over 15%. Economic development increasing the tax base in the CI room is pretty darn important to many of these growing cities. But I wanted to make sure that all of the people here that that are here for this testimony did understand, and that's why I asked the question of the two previous testifiers, while you're listed as opponents, in fact, you're not just cold and hard against reform, and I think that's a very important point that people do understand changes need to and will be made. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, as I sit here and listen to the testimony, it seems like there's two very different, not two, but there's a variety of different situations that we have before us. And so my concern is that we are really focused in on the differences and not just blanket moving forward. And so I do appreciate all the testimony here today to point out those differences. One thing that jumps out at me is from some of the testifiers who are in favor of the bill is, you know, there's a big difference, it seems, between people who have governmental entities who have embarked upon the eminent domain power with those who are okay with selling but just don't agree on the price. Seems like there's a big difference there between that situation and the situation in which they embark on the proceeding with those who just plain don't want to sell. And so I'm kind of looking at the differences in my own head as I move forward. But Mr. Grunhofer, can you help me out a little bit with, I'm not a lawyer, since we're all confessing our backgrounds. I'm not a meathead either. I happen to be an appraiser. But I'm just looking at the absolutely necessary piece that I think you brought out in your testimony. How does that differ legally from the but-for provision in the TIF standards? I'm just trying to maybe connect them, and maybe I ought not, but...
Mr. Grunhofer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, I think what we're trying to get there is that in establishment of a TIF district, and I am not a TIF district expert, but you can establish a TIF district and you can qualify properties as being blighted in that TIF district. And it's all in all likelihood, not all of those properties are going to sort of meet the definition of blight, but many of them will. And that's a requirement to establish that district for kind of redevelopment purposes. What this says is that you can take those dilapidated and blighted properties, but you cannot, though, take those other properties that might be in that district otherwise. So what you have is potentially a hole in the donut situation.
Representative Broad.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Grunhofer, I guess I'm still a little bit confused, but maybe Representative Johnson, maybe you can help me out. Is there any difference in your mind between using that absolutely necessary, and I guess I have concern over what that means. I know that how I view something as absolutely necessary is probably a little bit different than you or somebody else, depending on the situation, but is the but-for type language stronger, or is it more clear, or is it more confusing?
Mr. Grunhofer.
I think that was for me, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. I Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome.
And Representative Broad, my understanding, and again, this is Mr. McGrath might have a more scholarly answer than I have because he practices in this area of law, but my understanding is that the absolutely necessary definition may be a bit higher than the but-for, but it is much clearer because it's defined. And so that is probably a positive thing. But as several people have mentioned, we're happy to work together, and I'm more than happy to do that as we talk about specific language in the bill as well.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, my question is for Mr. McGrath. Chair, Mr. McGrath, do you agree that I'll call it the Johnson bill because it doesn't have a number at this time, does change the entire system for local government to acquire property? And if you do agree with that, don't you also agree that the thing that you're mostly concerned about are these private-to-private transfers that you've spoken about today?
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, as Representative Johnson said at the beginning, this is a comprehensive change. This is not tweaking. The real core of this bill is that it prohibits economic development. Like the unblighted case in Kelo, where Suzette's, where both parties stipulated that Suzette Kelo's home was not blighted. And so situations like the one in Richfield, where there were 80 homes that in all most everyone agrees were unblighted, those could not be taken under this bill. Additionally, this bill defines blight, but it defines it clearly, crisply. And every example, every photograph that you saw this afternoon, I'm not an engineer, but those buildings and those photographs looked blighted to me and looked like they could be taken down by the definition of blight that is in this bill. I submit to you that very little, if any, of the representatives who spoke today against this bill would be stopped, because the bill allows for the taking of roads, the taking of blighted property, and the taking of public nuisance. The one example of crime, I believe it was not White Bear Lake, but the city after that, excessive crime is a reason and is allowed to be taken under this bill. What this bill does, Representative Ellison, is that it stops economic development like the type we saw in Richfield and like the $400,000 and $500,000 and $600,000 condos that were built in St. Louis Park. It doesn't stop roads, blight mediation.
Representative Ellison.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. And so, as I understand your testimony, you really are concerned about these private-to-private transfers. That's what really, that's the evil you're trying to stop in this case. And so I guess my question is, wouldn't it be better, and wouldn't we sort of be able to bring the parties, the two sides of this thing together, if we focused our attention on that? The situation like in Richfield you mentioned, that's clearly something that you're concerned about and have reason to be. I don't want to put any judgments on it, but reason to be. Is focusing on that area of concern something that you believe you can talk with the other parties in this who represent, you know, like Mr. Grunhofer, and other individuals, Mr. Carlson, to try to get to a point where there's a bill we can get a little closer together on?
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, thank you for that question. I believe that the League of Cities will approach this in a good faith effort to address the Kelo decision, which was a decision that empowered the City of New London to take non-blighted property. I hope they're there with us, that non-blighted property should not be taken as the first take. Never mind the holdout problem. We can discuss that elsewhere. Secondly, I trust the League of Cities will negotiate on a reasonable definition of blight. We believe we presented a reasonable definition of blight. I give you an example of how the blight definition has been misused. That is that the city of Minneapolis declared the northeast corner of 50th and France blighted. Representative Ellison, if 50th and France is blighted, the entire state of Minnesota is blighted. The loose definition of blight that currently exists needs to be tightened. We welcome the opportunity to work with the League of Cities and the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities to do those two important things as they relate to public use, which is prohibit pure, unblighted, Kelo-like economic development and tighten the definition of blight.
Last question.
Representative Ellison, that's fine, but I'm supposed to announce that we've got maybe a minute or two left before we'll turn it over to the author for some final remarks. Representative Ellison.
So have you, Mr. McGrath, spoken with representatives of the League of Cities about this? How often have you talked with them? And what are the prospects for some compromise on both sides of this thing?
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, we did meet with the League of Cities, and I have had at least one telephone conversation with one of the attorneys at the League of Cities. We welcome the opportunity to come for them to come forward and show their proposal. We have presented ours, and we think it's a reasonable proposal. But and I might add, after our meeting with the League of Cities, we modified this proposal that you saw because we thought their criticism was constructive. We welcome the opportunity to continue to do that.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. With that, members and folks in the audience, we'll turn it back to the author, Representative Johnson, for his final remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Ellison, just so you know, I've met, and I believe that Senator Bach has met with the cities, I think, a couple times for me. And we did make a very significant change to the blight definition regarding crime based upon some of the thoughts that they gave us. And we don't expect that nothing's going to change in this bill before we get done. I suspect it will. But we are going to be pulled in both directions, just so you know, because there are some people who do think this is much too soft, which will make it interesting. Three thoughts. One of them Mr. McGrath just mentioned, but as I listened to the testimony, I may have heard one example of an economic development project that would not have occurred under this bill. I think every single other example would have still fit the definition. There were several examples of contaminated, environmentally contaminated property that's allowed under this bill. There were a couple of situations where I would be very surprised if this did not fall under either the definition of blight or possibly a public nuisance when you start talking about people dumping chemicals on land. Most people's definition of a public nuisance that would fall under. So I think that there maybe are some overstatements being made. There was a lot of examples of actual public uses, like roads and parks, that were given. That is not prohibited by this bill. What seems to be a concern is that even for those true public purposes, there may be an additional cost, because now individuals who before could never afford to challenge City Hall or county government or state government can, because if they win, they get their attorney's fees back, if they win. So they still have to make a difficult choice, because if they lose, they still have to pay the attorney's fees. I think that's a fair trade-off. I heard Mr. Jamboy say that this will not slow down redevelopment. He said this will end redevelopment. And I think I've been accused a couple times of hyperbole in this debate, but that is that's stretching it considerably. This bill will not forever end any possibility of redeveloping land by finding truly willing buyers. I imagine it happens all the time. And this bill won't stop that from happening all the time. It won't stop redevelopment in blighted areas, in environmentally contaminated areas, for abandoned property, for public nuisances. There will still be plenty of redevelopment going on. Say this will end redevelopment is quite a statement to make, I would say. And then finally, my last thought, actually two final thoughts. I heard Mr. Grundhofer criticize judicial second guessing of local public officials a couple times. And I guess my question is, since when have we thought that it was bad to allow courts to address an issue of a potential violation of someone's constitutional rights? Since when have we thought that publicly elected officials should be the final say on whether someone's constitutional rights have been violated? I can't imagine there's another example of that. And so people should have access to the courts, and courts should be second-guessing these issues. And then finally, the last couple of testifiers talked about how this was going to affect, as you mentioned, Representative Ellison, situations that are truly public, like roads and schools and parks and things like that. And I'm assuming that their concern is that people might actually now be able to challenge the government in court if they don't think they're being given a fair amount, and that the process is more open. That will slow things down in certain situations, and that will cost more money in certain situations, again, if the government loses because they were lowballing in their offer. I'm willing to make that trade-off. In closing, I guess I would say that I appreciate all the testimony on both sides. I do think this is a very reasonable bill, but one of the reasons we're having this hearing so early is that we have some time to work on it before session starts. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. And since I'm the one fortunate enough to hold a gavel at the end of the meeting, on behalf of the House Civil Law Committee, I want to thank the City of Blaine and everybody who attended today's meeting, and the meeting is now ended.